It's very interesting. It's a brilliant question. So people often ask me that, how can regulation ever be in front of things? And I do say it's quite hard because people don't understand sometimes how regulation is paid for. It's usually a cost on the regulated profession. There's some sort of levy. It's not a kind of free service. Years ago in the UK, we made the decision to have a lot of regulation to be one removed and independent of the actual department that might be the sponsor body. I'm not sure people always really understand that. And so for me, it's about AI or not. How can you be proportionate in the balance of regulation versus cost and benefit? Benefit might not be in today's terms. It may be that it's something about you're ensuring that there isn't a bigger problem, but it's how do you ensure that you aren't stifling innovation? And so for me, the approach that some of the regulators are taking now around using regulatory response units, I chair something for the MoJ around law tech, which is called the regulatory response unit. And it's a kind of equivalent of a sort of sandbox approach when some of the newer ideas that are emerging out of the regulated professions, how do policymakers deal with it when it might be an issue now that works across different regulators? There might be a bit of a legal aspect, there's a financial aspect, and guess what? There might also be something around whether or not people need to be qualified.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Heads Talk with me, Elaine Pringle-Schwitter, the podcast where we talk to C-level executives, leaders of institutions, and heads of multinationals. What are the current topics they talk? We listen.
Can you imagine getting into a business or a market where you actually spend 100 billion plus on a piece of paper?
Are you kidding me?
It was like a frying pan to the head.
I got nothing against CFOs.
It was not just the job of a lifetime, it was the job of a thousand lifetimes.
My guest today brings over two decades of regulatory leadership and strategic expertise to her current role. Having held prominent positions with regulatory bodies and the civil service, she now serves as the CEO of a global professional body. Additionally, she holds key roles as chair, board member, and non-executive director across several organizations within the law and financial sector. Her dedication to leadership development and continuous learning is evident through her active participation in esteemed groups, such as the Cabinet's Office Major Project Leadership Academy, the Alumni Network of the Oxford University Said Business School, and the City of London's Corporation Leaders of Tomorrow. A very insightful conversation awaits us today in Heads Talk, but before we get into that, here's a brief message.
FinTech Week London is a week-long celebration of London's innovative fintech scene from 10 until the 14th of June. Get your tickets now for our flagship conference on Thursday the 13th of June at the Park Plaza Victoria, London. Join us and meet over 1,000 senior decision makers from the leading fintechs, banks, investment firms, regulatory bodies, insurers, and service providers. Get your tickets now on www.fintechweek.london.
This episode is sponsored by Axia. Axia is the leading private cloud platform in the Alessian and Mattermost ecosystem, combining intelligent solutions with security and control. Axia's clients profit from digitalization and automation of critical business processes in a cloud and hybrid architecture. 150 staff provide migration, engineering, and support services to over 200 leading organizations in 32 countries.
Heads Talk podcast with your host Elaine Pringle-Schwitter.
As someone who has put their heart and soul into their business, have you forgotten to look after your own finances and future planning? My name is Victoria McLagan, and I'm a lawyer and trust and estates practitioner and founder of EWPS. I'm a trusted advisor and have been helping my clients and their families with wills, powers of attorney, and probate for over 17 years. If you would like to talk through your future financial protection and will planning on a fixed fee basis, please contact me at victoria@ewps.ch for a free, no obligation chat.
Heads Talk podcast with your host, Elaine Pringle-Schwitter.
Tracy Vegro is the Chief Executive Officer of the Chartered Institute for Securities and Investment. Prior to joining CISI in September 2022, Tracy held key executive positions at prominent regulatory bodies. As Executive Director of Strategy and Innovation at the Solicitors Regulation Authority, she spearheaded the delivery of the SRA Corporation Strategy while overseeing critical portfolios including innovation, regulatory policy, and education. Tracy's leadership was similarly impactful during her tenure as the Executive Director of Strategy and Resources at the Financial Reporting Council, where she led diverse teams focusing on strategy, risk management, HR communications, and economics. She was awarded an OBE in the 2020 New Year's Honours List for services to business and diversity. Her commitment to professional development is evident through her participation in programmes like the High Potential Development Programme and numerous secondments, including to the Cooperative Group, where she played a pivotal role in implementing governance reforms. Let's now have a conversation. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Tracy to Headstock. Delighted to have you here today.
And I'm delighted to be here and discussing lots of burning issues. Thank you so much for having me.
Excellent, excellent. Okay, let's get right into it. Let's start with this. Give my listeners a sort of a detailed introduction to the Chartered Institute of Securities and Investment, otherwise known as CISI. When was it established? What is the purpose?
Yeah, so we have a very interesting background. We were essentially the training arm of the London Stock Exchange, and we were spun out to be independent about 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So we've got the unusual kind of backstory that we're an educational charity, and we take our educational objectives very, very, very seriously. Mm-hmm. But we're also a membership body, and we're a global membership body spanning now over 100 countries. Because, of course, what's so important in some of the newer economies is the rule of law, English as a spoken language, mm-hmm. some of the principles about how financial services and professional services are conducted. So things like ethics, integrity, professional mm-hmm. standards, mm-hmm. Almost bodies like CSI are setting, I would say, the lead above perhaps some of the work that is done in my old life as a regulator, mm-hmm. where you're often solving a problem from some problem that's already happened, not mm-hmm. really the issues that you need to focus on in a fast-moving global economy of the future. So the reason I'm here and I'm so attracted to the job, I've been here 18 months now, is that with my background as a policymaker on financial services legislation back in the old days in the department, mm-hmm. and then latterly as a regulator, and as you talked about, I've often been seconded out to bodies like the cooperative when they got into some sort of trouble. You know, their bank got into trouble because there was a big corporate governance failure. I'm really delighted to know how well it's doing now, the group, but you know, it went through a particularly turbulent time. Mm-hmm. And for me, the remit of a body like CSI is to make sure that ethics and integrity and principles like that really do live day to day in mm-hmm. every one of our members, every one of our exam candidates. Mm-hmm. And that it's a message we present globally is an important one for the UK economy. Professional services, I never tire of telling people, is now one of the biggest exports. And mm-hmm. so when other bodies like, you know, the Stock Exchange in Ethiopia or somewhere else wants to model what we do, I think that's really important and we should be proud of that.
Mm-hmm. You said you're a global organisation with over 100 countries. Can you just give us an indication, and probably not list the 100 countries, but sort of indication of some of the places where you're based, where your organisation
is? Yeah. So as an organisation, we have an office in Dubai, which serves a lot of the Middle Eastern countries. Again, you can see how the logic for them is they're moving away from oil, they're diversifying yeah. their economies, they're trying to retain more of their young professionals who maybe have taken their degrees elsewhere, but they want to attract them back. So they are a massively important market for us because the regulator there essentially has followed the regulatory approach here. So the investment banking, wealth management sectors, they all take our examinations. And then the attraction for us is that, you know, they stay on as our members. We have a global alumni network. So the Middle East is very important. Also, equally, we're developing activities countries, now with some of the other Commonwealth countries. We have a massive office presence in the kind of former Commonwealth nations. Mm-hmm. And that's very important to us, because that link, that sort of professionalism, standards, integrity resonates very well. Mm-hmm. And is very important for people, as we all know. Mm-hmm. Financial planning and asset management is not just to preserve of the wealthy. People, ordinary people whose day-to-day pensions are invested, mm-hmm. Need to understand a little bit more. So things like financial literacy and so on is also something we tackle in different mm-hmm. countries. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the work we do with some less developed nations, we do under our charitable objectives. And we have very clear objectives around public education, awareness building, financial literacy is very important for us, making sure that things like pension planning, understanding how long term you now need to be in relation to how you manage your money, both in the short and the long term, is growing in importance, certainly here in the UK, but we're also seeing it elsewhere. And then the other thing that I'm very proud of, AI and the ethics of AI. We're hearing so much about AI. For me, it's a tool. And actually, if it can forecast, manage risk, build scenarios that then help people understand what they may or may not want to do with their savings, mm-hmm. that can be a good thing. So that's a certification program that we've seen very, very good, strong uptake for in countries like Australia, Paper, with whom we are partnering now for the first time. So, Okay. We have our own operations. We are very fortunate. We're based out in Colombo in Sri Lanka, because we spun out of the Stock Exchange, which is where they have their IT. And that's actually becoming quite a strong emerging market. So after a period of terrible turbulence in their economy, it's developing into one of the most sustainable economies mm-hmm. in the world. Mm-hmm. And actually, we're very fortunate to have a team of around 90 people there.
So thanks for that. That's kind of a very detailed answer on question one. You covered some of the topics that we're going to talk about in greater detail later. So thanks for the introduction on that. We're talking about, you know, integrity, ethics, mm-hmm. stuff. But, you know, something you said, and I just want to throw in this sort of side question before I get back on track, which was, you talked about policy making. I'm just wondering, this is your bag. This is something you've been doing for years. How has that changed now with all this sort of digital transformation, with AI and all that sort of stuff? Because we always, you know, everybody knows with these transformation, regulations tend to be miles behind. So what's happening there?
It's very interesting. It's a brilliant question. So people often ask me that. How can regulation ever be in front of things? And I do say it's quite hard, because people don't understand sometimes how regulation is paid for. It's usually a cost on the regulated profession. There's some sort of levy. It's not a kind of free service. Years ago in the UK, we made the decision to have a lot of regulations be one removed and independent of the actual department that might be the sponsor body. I'm not sure people always really understand that. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's about AI or not. How can you be proportionate in the balance of regulation versus cost and benefit? Benefit might not be in today's terms. It may be that it's something about you're ensuring that there isn't a bigger problem, yeah. But it's how do you ensure that you aren't stifling innovation? And so for me, the approach that some of the regulators are taking now around using regulatory response units, I chair something for the MOJ around law tech, which is called the regulatory response unit. And it's a kind of equivalent of a sort of sandbox approach, mm-hmm. when some of the newer ideas that are emerging out of the regulated professions, how do policymakers deal with it when it might be an issue now that works across different regulators? There yeah. might be a bit of a legal aspect, there's a financial aspect, and, you know, guess what, there might also be something around whether or not people need to be qualified to practice that mm-hmm. approach. Mm-hmm. So for me, it really is about rethinking what are the expectations around some of these institutions. And it's you could call it regulation, or you could call it policy making, or you could call it governance. How are we going to redefine some of these terms to be future focused and future orientated? Because the world is, to me, all about the people who can innovate and get new products and services or new ways of engaging with a customer base. And therefore, the whole market expands. You know, people talk about legal deserts and people who can't afford to get legal help. They often then get a very suboptimal outcome, even if it be on a sort of employment law matter. And I might find the same in pension advice and so on. So auto enrollment is great, isn't it? But if you don't know what you're enrolling in and manage that process. So the real short answer to your question is you've got to absolutely, as a regulator, have the word innovation in what you do. And it's not about self-regulation or light touch regulation. For me, it's about appropriate regulation. And I would really welcome policymakers and politicians and the public having a bigger debate about that.
I think we're going to touch a little bit more once again about regulations, especially sort of in the different countries and consistency and culture and how is that impacted. But first, let's talk about in your first answer, you talked briefly about it when you talked about pensions and financial literacy and training. But let's talk about your passion, that is lifelong learning, and with the next set of questions. First, sort of, you know, considering the rapid changes and advancements with the financial services industry, how does the CISI, the Chartered Institute for Securities and Investment, adapt its professional qualifications and training courses to ensure they remain relevant and effective for its members globally?
Well, that's the key question for me and for our board. You know, professional services and financial services are very fast moving areas. And as you articulated right at the start, we've got a global membership. So not everybody is identikit. So for me, it's about ensuring that our qualifications and training courses and then our continued professional development, the experience of being one of our members is relevant at every stage of your career. So many people come to us initially because their firms who are regulated are requiring them to do some of our qualifications. So that's the easy bit, isn't it? Where we've got the regulatory mandate, people basically have to sit our qualifications and examinations. That's the easy part. So for me, the challenge is then, what are you doing to ensure that the continued professional development is attractive, is actually delivered in a way people can say, you know, this made a difference to my career. So we have got things like, you know, a new learning platform. You know, many people think that everybody wants to take their learning in the same way. I've definitely come to the conclusion that's not true. Many people want to be part of a membership organization because they want to meet people and they want to go to events. That's fine. But other people actually want to be able to do their development because they realize that most careers now are not going to be linear in the way that many people's used to be. So you'd often join as a graduate somewhere, wouldn't you? Yes. You'd stay with X company for life. That's how it worked. You retire on a comfortable pension at sort of 60. Never going to happen again for probably youngsters joining the workforce now. Number one, their expectations of what the workplace is going to be all about are very different. There's also the point about no career is not going to be subject to change. You touched on AI, but you could also talk about what does hybrid working mean? You know, we've all come out of the COVID pandemic. And we've all discovered, guess what? There's even more disruption in the world. And we saw what happened in Ukraine and elsewhere. So, you know, what does it mean to have an approach to learning that's adaptable? And that's not just for us as the kind of provider of that learning, but it's about what does the sector need? I spoke at the Financial Services Skills Commission conference here in London yesterday, and I did a session with somebody who completely retrained at Lloyds Banking Group. And they hadn't bought in talent. They're no longer paying a fortune for IT talent. They're retraining people. And again, bodies like ours can really be part of that journey for many of the organisations now who are looking at people strategies that are going to touch into, you know, decades hence, and they're planning now. So for me, it's about adaptability and awareness of just how fast the pace of change is. And that, to me, it's not all about just tech changes. It's about people's workplace expectations. I see it in my own teenage daughters, you know, still students. They are looking at, they're really, really picky. You know, they're looking critically at companies that people in my era would have said, oh my, I'm amazed I got an offer there. And they wouldn't even begin to think about, do I take it or not? So I think for employers dealing with the generation that are coming out of universities now, they've actually got to make themselves a little bit more marketable. And it's perhaps the balance has shifted somewhat. And again, that's true of us as a professional body. We are going to be relevant at every stage of your career is how I present it.
Okay, so that's good. So we talk about relevance. We talked about the adaptability of CISI and we talked about the effectiveness. Let's sort of look at consistency, because you know we've mentioned it with over sort of 50,000 members in 104 countries. How does CISI ensure consistency? You must get all the time. Ensure consistency is in raising standards, and we've talked about this, raising standards of knowledge, skills, and behavior across diverse cultures and regulatory landscape. I'm just saying, how do you maintain a level playing field with all of this?
No, you're absolutely right. And maintain a level playing field whilst recognizing diversity is important. So it's the key question, isn't it? And what I would say is it's about ensuring that the starting point for us is always the, you know, the appropriate standard. So as I say, it's really easy where there's a regulatory requirement and we follow it. But even there, I always talk about going above and beyond. So for me, principles around how we have good methodologies for our learning frameworks. How do we create data and information that then at any one time, a busy professional can say, oh, actually, I'm going to take an hour of my day there and do this. So it's the mechanisms by which you provide some of the continued professional development. The other thing is I'm going to make a big shout out for a lot of the people who help us. So again, our sector is a very, very buoyant one, and people are very happy to volunteer and give us feedback, really help sort of be chief examiners, practitioner panels. We have fora across a number of issues, you know, today's budget day in the UK. And, you know, we've got people who will already be giving their observations and analysis. These are people who are quoted in journals like the FT and so on. So, you know, we're lucky in our membership to have almost, you know, real kind of bench strength, if you like. And we try and utilize that. The other thing I say all the time is you cannot underestimate how you need to be clear that you're doing three or four things really well, and that these standards, and it is back to how people meet things like the consumer duty. What are the things you cannot get wrong? What are the things that are absolutely core to everything we put out? And I think that helps you get consistency, because you're not trying to kind of respond to everything. We're not a kind of buy one, get one free type organization. We are really, really strong on the things that we practice ourselves and encourage our members to practice. So ethics, integrity, professional standards. I think bodies like chartered bodies with a royal charter and a history like we have, you often can get more out of your members and get more of a step change than probably anybody could with just a rule change or a law change, if you see what I mean. So for me, it's the third triangle. You know, you've got the financial services legislation, but not everybody's a lawyer, not everyone's reading that hourly. And then the regulators have their job to do. But we probably, in terms of building trust and confidence with clients and consumers, I'd say our remit is is stronger and more positive, because people do understand the nature of ongoing professional development. Most people join a profession and they value that professional standing.
You know, as you mentioned earlier, when you talked about teenagers, you know, young people sort of, they're on the ball with this, especially in their choices of employers, their choices of where they buy things, where they purchase things, and what they promote. So, and it's, you know, integrity and ethics, as you mentioned, are core values for CISI. How do you actively promote this, ensure this, and cultivate this, especially in countries where you're based, where Perhaps some of the ethics is seen as a luxury that cannot be afforded.
Yeah, so first and foremost, you're absolutely right. Maintaining that message and that high standards everywhere once you're a global body is always difficult, isn't it? So years ago I was seconded out to Procter and Gamble. I was on a sort of career break because we needed to be overseas, and I was amazed how strict they were about from the minute they acquired an entity, it became Procter. Things were changed overnight, and woe betide anybody who didn't understand that that change had happened. I learned though then that that had adverse consequences, because obviously you can like win hearts but not minds, or win minds and not hearts.
Yes, I was thinking that.
And where do you want to be? So people are so frightened, and they logically get it, so they do things, but they don't do it with that passion. So for me, it's all about us taking the message of standards of integrity and getting the head and the heart. So I don't just want the regulatory mandate. I want us to be an outstanding global body, because the people who are engaged with us really are saying positive things. So again, I'm very old-fashioned, but it's nice when somebody takes the time to send you some feedback and saying, you know what, this really has opened up doors for me. This has enabled me to do X and Y. I never thought I would have done that. As an educational charity, we're lucky in that we can fund some activities in countries that people wouldn't be able to pay the rates that we would charge here. And actually, they're the people who are going to be the leaders and the champions of the future for us. And so for me, I see it as part of our kind of educational remit that we do make the case, both with the head and the heart, for why integrity and professional standards of the highest, order are important. So for me, it's a pleasure to be doing some of the work. And I don't think it's harder, but I think it's one where we utilize that balance of professional body and charitable objectives in a bit more of an equal balance, if you like. Whereas you could argue in some other nations, it doesn't really resonate like that, out with some of the countries like Australia. They are kind of almost copying the process we have. Many people have reviews of regulation. The start point, often I can say this as someone who used to do this, is looking around at what other people do. Where's the benchmark? I think it's really good for the UK that we really are still that international benchmark.
I think that's good, and I want to dice. I want to sort of dig deeper into what you've just talked about, because we've said from the start, lifelong learning is championed by CISI. So it's almost like if you could provide a case study, if you could just share some innovative approaches or initiatives the Institute has implemented to encourage continuous professional development among its members worldwide. Is there something where you thought, okay, this is a very innovative approach developed within CISI that I'd like to share with the listeners here in this talk?
Yeah, I'll talk about a few things. So I think what I would say is most people don't understand that there are a range of tools you can deploy as a professional body. So things like looking at life skills, not just the professional banking examinations element of it. And we've tried to do that through having things that we call them micro modules. So the sort of things that people now listen to, like podcasts. You put your earphones in, and while you're sitting on the train in the morning, you're listening. That often has more impact, because it then gets somebody to do more in-depth learning. But bite size is one of the things we think we're pretty proud of. The other thing I wanted to mention was our online learning platform. So again, in COVID and the shift to going and doing more things online, and Teams and Zoom and all the rest of it, was quite an enabler of people being able to do joining up for learning across all the different countries we're in. So when I do a lunchtime event with Women in Finance Rwanda or something, I can now do that. Whereas if I'd had to get a flight and get there and do it in person, it just wouldn't happen. So utilizing the fact that you can work digitally to promote joining up and a kind of virtual network is also very important, I think, for how you are keeping this sort of lifelong learning journey going. The other thing is, I would say, constantly think about how people are having to adapt. And that's adapting to either changing employer, working in a hybrid world? What are we learning about the advantages and disadvantages, and how much are we sharing some of that? Mm-hmm. So I talk about interactivity as a principle. Now, it's not something you could kind of do in an examine, but it is something that for us as a body that is promoting membership and learning, we've got to look at it in new ways. And the concept of interactivity, I characterize by, you know, I'm not sitting here giving my version of what I think will happen next. I'm looking at where the behavioral insights are, what data is there available. I sit on the board of the Financial Services Skills Commission, and they do lots of research. So how do we factor all that into the development work we do on some of our new learning? Taking feedback, polling members around, did you see this? Did it help? You said you wanted work to prepare people to be non-executive directors or trustees. Did you like the modules? Did you do it? Don't let things just stay out there if they're not working. Pilot things, adapt. Get feedback. But they're principles for me about how you become a learning organization that really people do value. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I would talk about is never assume that things like life skills are taught in schools. Or for me, one of the biggest revelations in coming here was how people like the Young Professional Networks really, really value a membership body way more than you would imagine, because they've not necessarily had some of the the sort of project management type skills, the understanding of profit and loss accounts and sales, and some of the things that you might have thought were more sort of traditionally taught themes. They've just been crowded out the curriculum. So I think that's another area where that transition into your first professional, you know, first 5 years as a professional in financial services, a body like ours can really come in with some focused learning. And then finally, I'd say on all of it, there's a whole issue around health and well-being now, which is not really classic territory for a membership body or a professional standard setter. But every day I'm struck by just how issues around culture in an organization and mental health and well-being mm-hmm. are just so more brought into stark relief. You know, I'm not sure when this sort of transition happened, but it seems to me very real now that more people are really struggling with all sorts of issues. And mm-hmm. it's good that people are talking about neurodiversity and all of these things, but I'm not sure it seems that there's one place where anyone's gathering any of this information. So we try and do a little bit around that too, just in response to what members are asking us, and things like mental health, first aid training and things like that. We're just doing a little bit more linking up with some other organisations. And again, I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think you can always know everything, but you can do supportive partnerships occasionally. And we've tried to do a little bit of that. And the other thing, I like collaboration. So working with other bodies, a lot of our members come from other professional organisations too. So people like accountants want to broaden what they offer in terms of client services. And sometimes estate management and things like that in the legal sphere cuts across to what we do. Where does this sort of link with insurance markets and so on? So we've been very keen to work in alliance with other bodies as well. And on things like some of the green financing and climate change issues and sustainability, we work in alliances with different people, and I think that enables us to keep things really relevant and fast moving world. We can actually share information with members. So they're all some of the things that we've been doing. And as I say, you know, don't assume it's a one size fits all. Pilot things, be responsive to member feedback. They're the things that I think help you get your learning offer right.
I'm going to ask a question about collaboration, so I'm glad you brought it up. But before I do that, you talked about offering sort of well-being, health, I don't know, mindset mm-hmm. training, even neurodiversity information provision. How is that accepted in different countries, and what country surprises the most in terms of how it welcomes the information and takes it like a sponge, and what's not?
I think it's less country specific in terms of it being an issue, but it's your point very well made about how much they are open about it and how much they talk about it. So again, it's one of the benefits potentially of doing stuff virtually. You can do it in a way you're not having to put your hand up in a meeting. Mm-hmm. You're not having to look like the one person who's got this problem or mm-hmm. suffer any of that kind of, it's almost mm-hmm. loss of face, isn't it, as a professional? Yeah. People perhaps don't want to let colleagues know that they've got some. Exactly. And so I think it's the methods by which we delivered some of it that's probably helped us. And again, I try and think from a sort of charitable objective, that's a good way of us doing a little bit of good. Because if someone can log in under their ID to our learning platform and they can curate this and it's in their own space, mm-hmm. that's much better than them having to do it, as it were, in a public where I think it would be difficult. But otherwise, I am mindful that different countries, you know, you quite rightly said in the introduction, I got an honour awarded for what I did on board diversity when I was at the Financial Reporting Council, which is the governance regulator here in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I am amazed how we are still in this week of International Women's Day with issues. And you think, how, when so many people start out as young graduates, equal proportion of men and women joining a firm, why is it then that so few women still make partner? And some of the issues, not only in the context of mental well-being, but just in the context of how different people manage their careers. And why is it still that we see far less men taking paternity leave, where it's assumed that mat leave is going to be as long as possible? And it's, you know, we still cultural issues. And I do think, again, it's not core to all we do as a membership body, but it does strike me that having a discussion on EDI is something that everybody now needs to do, because employers are going to start hitting some real trouble if there's no pipeline of talent. And you can't grow it overnight. So things like that too, that are the sort of not quite well-being, but are about opportunity enhancement for the whole of your organization, because otherwise you're not going to get the youngsters joining. People are looking as newbies quite a lot. I mean, whenever I interview people these days, I look on and think, crikey, I wouldn't have had the confidence to ask that. So in a way, it's positive, but there's a bit of an expectation gap, isn't there? And I'm how we're all going to be dealing with that. You know, if I were a chief people officer somewhere, what are the markers I'm going to be saying to my board now I need to really think about, or we need to look at how we're going to manage this? Because you don't want to have a sort of complete gap, do you, in a few years in different sectors, because, you know, it's the work.
I think we have gaps already. So, you know, you don't want the gaps to expand in some sense.
And it's a sort of a worry. So there are things like that that, you know, are not core to what we do, but we're trying to just really just get into a little bit of understanding, a little bit of polling of some of our members, particularly the younger professionals.
All right. Okay. As this series is all about fintech and finfluencing, naturally, as you mentioned, collaborations will come up in the conversation. I wonder with, you know, when I do some research and look at the details, you've got 446 associated members, and you also have a significant presence on LinkedIn. How does CISI, I always get that wrong. How does CISI,
no, slip off the tongue, don't worry.
use its network and platforms to sort of share knowledge and foster collaboration in the financial services community and beyond? You mentioned a tidbit of it earlier, but if you can expand on that.
Yeah, so again, we collectively at my board level, but also in the organisation, we try and really have that sort of presence, not just internationally, but regionally here in the UK. Mm-hmm. So we have a kind of branch committee structure. You'll be pleased. Leeds is a massive hub of fintech, the Northwest, Manchester, growing, Edinburgh up in Scotland. These are some of our most active committees. So for me, it's about working with the grain of your membership. Mm-hmm. We are lucky. Many of the profiles and things, if you look on LinkedIn, are about members of us, excuse me, who Have grown businesses, have a presence well beyond what you might imagine. Excuse me. So we can really showcase some of that. And that's one of the ways. The other thing, we do a lot of sponsorship. We have global student ambassadors. We have people who start with us in universities. That makes a big difference. People seeing and talking about the journeys different people have been on, that's something we can showcase pretty actively. And then the other thing is, the city is a small place, but a big place, because in that square mile, you've got so much connectivity and learning and so much focus about what is a vital skill, what's a nice to have skill, and what is the sort of thing that's really going to make you stand out. Now, whether or not you're a influencer or whether or not you're somebody who has forged a path very early with a new innovative way of providing a service, be that, online banking or an online conveyancing service or something new, that sort of groundbreaking approach to things is something that, again, you can put out very easily to fellow members. The number of people who trial things, as I said, we have a fintech forum. You can utilize that. You've got a lot of like-minded people who you can almost use as the sort of challenge panel, or we did a tech sprint recently, just amongst ourselves here in the office. So those new approaches to things, doing it in a kind of safe space, I think is quite an opportunity for a body like ours. And then if you can utilize your global links and do it with a couple of different nations, that is a very interesting way of looking at how you develop ideas in a safe way. And you're not doing it in a sort of anti-competitive or in a way that is kind of weakening your hand, quite the opposite. But I think there are things like that. You've just generally got to have an innovative outlook in the current climate. It's an awful cliche, isn't it? But change is a constant. And for anybody saying, oh, our model is X and it's always been X, you'd be saying, well, she's mad. You've got to adapt. Who knows what the Chancellor is saying right now in the budget? But there could be all sorts of things. And there's always the line of unintended consequences. So, sometimes people think X is going to have Y result. But I certainly learned as a policymaker when I first started out as a new graduate in Whitehall, you often had unintended consequences. Everybody would be telling you something was a brilliant idea. You put it in a manifesto, you would execute it in legislation. And guess what? No change or nothing happened. Because you've got to have hearts and mind changes if you're really going to get that sort of step change, be it flexible working or shared parental leave, all of these big things that are then the backdrop to the working environment that we all operate within.
Okay. Let's end this episode of Ed's Talk with us looking ahead. As the CEO of CISI, how do you envisage the Institute's role evolving in the coming years to further enhance public trust and confidence in financial services, particularly in the light of emerging technologies and evolving regulatory environments?
Well, I mean, that is the sort of killer question, isn't it? How are you going to ensure that people can cope with change? A sector that is going to be, having to fight for talent, fight to retain that talent, and have a workforce that is adaptable and all the rest of it. It's no mean feat these days. I'm constantly reminded of just trust is very, very hard to win and very easy to lose. And you see examples of that in just about everywhere, don't you? Probably can't remember a sort of environment where there is so much political uncertainty and that sort of geopolitical backdrop being quite so complicated. Isn't there some stat that more of us and there are more people going to vote for the change of leader this year than sort of ever before in the developed world, And do you think it seems like a time where everyone is satisfied with the caliber of choices they have? I don't think
That's a
so.
whole nother podcast.
Yeah, true. So for me, the role of a professional body in helping ensure trust, because otherwise, at the end of the day, potential customer need just goes unmet. So it doesn't matter how well articulated your consumer duty is. If ultimately there's a lack of trust, nobody benefits. And certainly the people who are going to be retiring in 20 years' time aren't going to benefit. So for me, the challenge is to utilize learning, utilize relevance, high standards, accessibility of advice. All of those things are the heady mix that for me give a body like us, that's a charitable and a membership body with educational objectives, mm-hmm. the best place to be, because you probably can facilitate more actual on the ground change. And nothing makes me happier when you hear from one of our firms and members that actually they've done X and Y, they've done a pro bono week, actually yeah. in the free financial advice they gave in this particular thing has caused this, that, and the other to happen, all of which were positive things. So for me, the challenge is in a time of lots of change and uncertainty, trust is best built by offering two or three things that are really key to building standards and referencing what a particular sector can do. That really helps. I go back many times to the kind of years of all those, the Cadburys and all those people who, you know, were building the first factories when people were very worried about what was going to happen, what the change was going to be. Mm-hmm. And then they often looked after people who worked with them really well. You know, you have whole towns and houses that were built by the industrialists at the time. Yeah, what's the equivalent in terms of today's expectations? How people give something back? To me, it's about enabling good citizenship, because you're giving a service that is of a high standard, and then it's a win-win for all of us.
Tracy Vegro, OBE, a real pleasure today on Heads Talk. Many thanks for your time and insights.
Absolute pleasure talking to you, Elaine. Thank you so much. I've listened to some of your others and they're brilliant.
Thanks for joining me today on this episode of Heads Talk. Don't forget to subscribe to the show via my website, elainepringle.com/headstalk, or wherever you get your podcasts. Finally, I'd like to thank our sponsors, guests, and you for helping to make the show possible. Please join me next time, where I'll be featuring more executives, C-suite leaders, and heads of multinationals.
Heads Talk podcast with your host, Elaine Pringle-Schwitter.